Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwen Sheltimer, my co-host Felicity Signal-Reed, and our guest this week, iconic folk singer Garnet Rogers and Marianne Marizic, who is hosting a concert by Garnet in Coburg in September. Each week on this program, we visit with an author or sometimes an editor or publisher or even a singer-songwriter. We hope to find out a little about his or her life, what prompts them to write, and give them an opportunity to hear some of their work. We're very pleased today to have Garnet Rogers with us, who will shortly be giving a concert in Coburg at the home of Marianne Marizic, who is also here today to talk with us about it. So welcome, Garnet and Marianne.
Thank you.
Oh, nice to be here. Thank you.
Garnet Rogers is a legendary folk musician, singer, songwriter, and composer. Born in Hamilton, he has family roots in Nova Scotia. He began his professional career working with his brother, folk musician Stan Rogers. Since Stan's tragic death in 1983, Garnet has pursued his own solo career. His style is more modern than his brother's, influenced by blues, rock, country, and classical. He plays a variety of instruments, including guitar, mandolin, violin, and flute. Garnet released his last album in 2007, and since then has been writing songs and performing them on YouTube and other platforms. He has also released his memoir, Night Drive, Travels with My Brother, this year. Marianne Marizic is a well-known figure to the musical circles in Northumberland. She set up in 1998 and still teaches at the Metropolitan School of the Arts in Toronto, is a much sought-after piano teacher, wrote a delightful book for children called Cougar's Great Adventure, to teach the basics to those starting out their studies, and has recently organized a series of concerts held at her home here in Coburg. So, Garnet, the foreword to your memoir, Night Drive, Travels with My Brother, begins, "You should write this stuff down. People have been saying that to me for years now."
Yeah, as I said in the foreword, I didn't know whether people were just maybe wanting me to make an actual permanent record of these stories that I was telling whenever I had too much coffee or booze or sugar, and or whether they just wanted me to go in a corner somewhere and shut the hell up. The stories kind of evolved out of just party pieces. You know, I'd be in a gathering somewhere, or I'd be on stage, or maybe driving across country, and you'd be telling about your life the way you do with a friend. And I did start writing them down with no particular purpose in mind. I just, about 10 years ago, began writing, scribbling things in a binder. But then about 4 years ago, I finally got a laptop and I started putting them on files. And then 2 years ago, I got really serious and I just sat down and I read Stephen King's book on writing, which mm-hmm. was a wonderful kind of impetus it suddenly sort of gave me the key. I thought, I can do this. I can actually do this. And I sat down and every day for the next 8 months to a year, I would get up in the morning and be at the keyboard at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'd work until dinner. And I did that for 5 days a week. And then it became 6 days a week, and then 7 days a week.
Wow.
And it basically just took over my life, and it was really a enjoyable process. I got up every morning with a great sense of purpose, and I knew what I was going to do. And I spent a lot of time just for sitting there giggling to myself while I was talking away.
Well, you certainly produced a great volume here. It's 700 pages. There's a lot of memories there. The stories of your childhood and growing up, they explain how you came to follow the career you chose and pursue it. So
yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your youth and perhaps a little about your family.
Well, my parents, Al and Valerie Rogers, they both came from Nova Scotia. They met and married in Nova Scotia in 47. Anyway, they had to move to Ontario the way most people did to look for a job. It was pretty dire. It was post-war. The labor market was still problematical. And so for the first 2 years of my life, we lived in a tiny little, there were four of us, you know, my parents and my brother Stan and I, who was 5 years older than me. We lived in just the tiniest little house trailer, about maybe 6x8, outside of Stony Creek, Ontario. And Mom and Dad built a little house out of used lumber in between paychecks and after work. And that's what we moved into. And we kept really close ties with Nova Scotia. We would go down there you know, maybe once a month or so to see family and just be part of the scene down there still. And Dan and I, as children, got very quickly exposed to, I guess you'd probably call it real folk music. It was people who had no career, no aspirations to play professionally, but they were playing guitar and writing songs, and
it was all coming from the heart.
Yeah, and it was just music that everyone made. If you were having a party, and we did, you know, there were a lot of parties, and you brought a guitar or an accordion or a fiddle or something, and it was kitchen music. And
yeah.
So Stan and I got exposed to that very early on, and it became, I think unconsciously, we realized we had the keys to the kingdom, because folk revival hit back in the late 50s, early 60s. Here was this music. It was not terribly difficult to play if you had an instrument. You could pick up a Woody Guthrie song if you knew three chords on a ukulele or a mandolin.
Yeah.
And we were able to step into this sort of magic circle of a song. Like I say, having the keys to the kingdom. Like it didn't seem like a foreign idea to us that playing music. You know, music was not what you heard on the radio necessarily. It was just what you did.
Yeah. In this book, what is your favorite story about your brother Stan?
That's a hard one. I mean, he was one of the reasons I wrote the song or wrote the book was because he was such a complex character and incredibly brash and loud and vulgar, also extraordinarily tender and kind, and with an amazing ability to look into the human heart in his songs, and wildly frustrating for that reason, because you'd be just so angry at him for some horrible thing that he had done, and then you'd be on stage and he'd play some song. It's like, oh, well, I guess I can't leave the band after all. You know, and it happened all the time. I mean, you know, I got fired or I quit probably once a month over the 10-year period.
Well, that obviously isn't the highlight of your career as a singer-songwriter, but what would you say is a highlight from your career?
The extraordinary gift of being able to do it. There's a chapter in the book where I'm having this conversation with my dad, and he basically says, you know, if you're going to become a musician, then, you know, you've got to work at it. And your mother and I have been saving for your university education, and if you don't want to go to school, then use the money that we've saved for you to as a kind of a college fund, and you can learn everything you can over the next 4 years.
Yeah.
And you can borrow from that fund as long as you pay it back and learn the rudiments and learn how to be what you want to be. And then he said that the main thing is to don't ever get a job that you hate just to pick up a paycheck, which, of course, made sense to me. And then there was this little pause, and he said, like I did.
Wow.
And I said,
what a wonderful father.
Don't you like being a bricklayer? And he said, well, no, it's awful. You know, you have to stand in a trench all day and up to your knees in water and, you know, be yelled at. And it never even occurred to me my dad was making the sacrifice for us.
Huh. Well, perhaps we could ask you to read a small piece from your memoir, Night Drive, Travels with My Brother.
Sure. This actually takes place in Port Dover, Ontario. It takes place very, very early on in the story. Stan has just left home, and I'm a few years behind him. I'm still in school, but this will give you an idea of the way I was trying to approach the stories anyway.
Okay.
It was a beautiful summer night on the shore of Lake Erie. Stan and a friend were living in a trailer near Port Dover that year. Port Dover is now mostly known for the big Friday the 13th biker rally, which happens every Friday the 13th. No matter what kind of nut-freezing, pecker-shriveling weather it happens to be, the bikers turn up, thousands of them. Bikers are tougher. Bikers are different. Bikers don't care about the weather. Bikers are not that smart, actually. Port Dover was then a grubby little fishing town, still trying to cling to life, catching ever smaller numbers of the feeble and sickened fish that lived downstream from the industrial murk that poured into the water from Ohio. There was also a small carnival near the shore. Some resting rides and a circle of tiny patient ponies waiting to carry the next load of snottering midgets around for the parents' cameras. There were hot dogs, fries, burgers, and the smell of smoke and grease mingled with pony poop. It was paradise. It was also the place where the migrant teen workers would collect every night to spend their pay after a long day in the tobacco fields. Working in the tobacco fields was a rite of passage for a lot of kids around the country back then. They lived in tents and in barns and in the huge old mausoleum on Highway 6 outside of town. during the day they'd pick tobacco and then clean up as best they could and head for the bright lights and the beach, which was where we were at the moment. There was Stan and his buddy Bill and a couple of other guitar players all sitting around the fire. There was no driftwood on the shore, so we had to burn some old railroad ties. There was a lot of bad tarry smoke, and it was not so romantic, but hey, it was a fire, and we were all right. I was better than all right, actually. Stan had carefully poured me a half glass of beer mixed with ginger ale and said, "There, make that last, you're only getting the one." I was all of 14 years old, maybe. But here I was, sitting up with the older kids. There was music, there was firelight, and there were girls. Lots of girls, all too old for me, but I was sitting right next to one at that very moment, and she was wearing a bathing suit. And in that bathing suit were actual breasts, real, live breasts. And, if the legends were true, nipples. I was one happy little kid. The breeze was coming in from the south, and I could hear the waves as they gently rolled the dead fish onto the shore. One of the guys was singing an Eric Anderson song, Thirsty Boots. The others around the fire were chiming in, guitars, soft voices in harmony. The fire crackling and sputtering as the creosote flared up. It was a quiet and beautiful moment. Suddenly our little paradise was ruined by the sound of about 50 Harley Davidsons as they roared over the hill and spilled down towards us. "Oh, Jesus, quick, they'll see the fire," somebody hissed, and we made frantic efforts to douse the flames. But by now the railroad ties were fully ablaze and we were clearly visible in the ugly, smoky light. Jesus, what were we going to do? We'd heard stories of what bikers did to young and innocent girls. We'd seen the movies. More to the point, I'd heard stories of what bikers did to young and innocent boys with cute Prince Valiant haircuts. I had dreamt of someday having a serious romantic relationship, but not like this. The bikers did a half-circle pincer movement to cut off our escape. Our only way out now was to run into the filthy, stinking lake, and that was not going to happen, not even to avoid what was coming. I wondered, what would my new biker boyfriend call me? Would it be a cute name? There was no escape. We were doomed. Stan was carefully putting away his guitar and even more carefully strapping his large chrome Hamilton guitar cape over his fist like brass knuckles preparing to sell our lives dearly. The bikers were assembling in the darkness away from the firelight, milling ominously about and moving in for the kill. They were now just a darker shadow against the black night. Stan reached out to make sure where his girlfriend was. "Stay near me," he said. "If it gets bad, run for town." I could hear whimpering in the darkness, an annoying, high-pitched keening sound. Stan said, "Garnet, shut the hell up!" The bikers were coming closer. I could hear the jingle of the chains and the dull clunk of the souvenir human skulls they had tied around their waists. Closer. Closer. They were still advancing. Oh, God, we're all going to die. They stopped for a moment, still just outside the circle of firelight. Then the leader stepped forward into the flickering glow. He was terrifying, covered in matted hair and dark blue, smeary prison tattoos with chains and filthy, stinking leather made from the skins of deadly feral hogs he'd no doubt killed with his bare hands. He looked at Stan, who was presumably our leader, as he was the biggest of us. There was a long silence. The fire was still hissing and giving off foul-smelling steam from where some of us had frantically peed on it. Then the leader of the bikers spoke. He said, and I swear this is the truth, "Can you play Michael Row the Boat Ashore?"
Oh, that's delightful. Thank you, Connett. Now we'll take a short break.